Thank the choir for their song this morning. I thank Burns Fish for his participation in our service. Burns is part of a group I've been meeting with over this year called Worship Associates, people who I get together with to talk a little bit about our Sunday services and to invite them to take part from time to time. Speaking of which, I enjoyed our service last Sunday. We kicked off our annual pledge drive. In addition to it being a very well done service, and I thank those who did it, what made it especially enjoyable for me was that I could just sit at the back of the sanctuary there and take it all in, as it were. And those of you who were here may remember that throughout the course of that service, these little promos and advertisements and all got flashed up on the wall over here, just above that door. And at one point, one of the ones they put up there, as John was doing his professorial thing there, was about the programs and events and services and areas of interest and outreach and all the other kinds of things that we here at the congregation seek to offer and that we seek your support for. Well, somewhere in all that stuff that got put up there, a Kerouac reference got slipped in, implying that part of what goes on here are occasional references to this writer and his work. And I just want to say I had nothing to do with that going up there. Other people planned that service, but yeah, I do make occasional reference to his life and work. After that thing up there last Sunday, I figured, you know, if nothing else, for the sake of truth and integrity and advertising, well, maybe I would just lead into my sermon on the next Sunday with a reference from one of his novels. Since after all, you asked for this. All right. The novelist Dr. Sacks. It's one of five books out of the 18 that he published during his lifetime. It's one of five books that Kerouac wrote that recalls his growing up days in Lowell, Massachusetts. And the central event of Dr. Sacks is this New England flood that took place in the spring. I believe it was in the spring of 1936. That was the year that the Merrimack River over here rose well above its banks and caused considerable damage in the New England towns through which it flows. And many of the tributaries to the Merrimack, like the Nashua River that runs right just down at the bottom of the hill from the front of the church here, also overflowed its banks. And I understand that the Nashua River actually didn't get up above Canal Street, but it didn't make it all the way up. Fortunately, we're on a little higher ground up here, so it didn't get to the room that we're sitting in here. So our buildings were spared. Well, this was all a bit, of course, before my time, but I do know there are still some members of our congregation who can recall the flood of 1936. That was the year. In that year, Jack Kerouac was 14 years old. And Dr. Sacks is written from the perspective of his 14-year-old self in the person of a teenager named Jackie Dulowes. Of course, Jack's writing this thing as an adult, but he's looking back to 1936 in this flood. And at one point in the novel, young Jackie stands on one of those bridges going over the Merrimack River there in Lowell and watching the swollen river go rushing by in torrents and carrying all the stuff down the stream that it's picked up along the way, you know, trees and maybe a house or so here and there, and he's standing there on the bridge, and this is the passage that describes his thoughts. Unbelievably now, I returned to see the flood still rising after supper. The mighty roar beneath the bridge was still there, casting mist up into the sea air. I began to be afraid now of watching under the bridge. I tried to follow the brown, filthy wave crest for 100 feet and got dizzy. I began to dislike the flood, began to see it as an evil monster bent on devouring everyone for no special reason. Focus on just that last line. I began to dislike the flood, began to see it as an evil monster bent on devouring everyone for no special reason. The broad theme of Dr. Sacks, the novel itself, has to do with childhood and adolescent fantasies. Dr. Sacks is this imaginary creature in the young Kerouac's mind that he kind of imagines hovering around the haunts of of Lowell there. And having a 14-year-old see in the unthinking workings of a flooded river an evil monster bent on devouring everyone kind of fits into the overall fantasy motif of the novel itself. But I would suggest that just a couple of months ago, millions of persons all around the world became that boy on a Lowell bridge. As we witness by way of television and newspapers and other forms of media, the devastating effects, devastating with respect to loss of human life and the destruction of human property, of the tsunami wave that rose up out of the Indian Ocean in Southeast Asia and slammed into a wide range of shorelines in that part of the world. Latest death toll figure I've seen on this is 175,000 human lives. That's incredible. It's mind-boggling. I mean, however much our rational minds may tell us that this was just nature doing its natural thing, which in fact it was, it is hard not to see at some other level of our beings the same thing that little Jackie Dulawo saw there in the Merrimack River, an evil monster bent on devouring everything. Sometimes nature gets to a point and does things that we just personify without quite realizing what we're doing. That's what happened there. But the biggest challenge, I think, to the human mind and soul and spirit when it came to this mind-boggling event is found in those four additional words that Kerouac puts in the mind of his young Jackie Dulawos. For no special reason. In the face of a natural event of the magnitude that this adolescent is watching, he cannot help but ask why. The fact that he can find no reason really bespeaks a sense on his part that there's got to be a reason somewhere or somehow for the ferocity of nature that he is watching roar by. Perhaps in writing this passage, the adult Kerouac was recalling how the flood of 1936 wiped out his father's printing business, that he had a little print shop right along the banks of the river, and the flood just knocked it right out of there, inflicting a great deal of economic hardship upon his family. He may have been remembering how that river had, up to that time in his life, been a friendly and a nurturing presence in his childhood, a place where he and his friends played along the banks of this river, and now it undergoes this horrific transformation, so much so that he ascribes to it the human characteristic of monstrous evil. We'll hold that scene for just a moment. We'll return to it later. But first, we're going to return to the events of just a couple of months ago. For the reaction to this horrific transformation of a placid ocean into a tsunami came, as I watched it, it came in three stages. And each stage was sort of like right on top of the other. They all happened in very rapid kind of fashion. The first one was just kind of shock and disbelief at the devastation itself. All those people and all those homes and villages, entire towns just wiped out. It took some doing just to comprehend that piece of it. And right on top of that comes the second stage, which was and still is, well, we've got to do something about this. And that second stage is still ongoing. It's in very commendable, in some very heartening kinds of ways. And it grew out of this sense, as I was trying to talk with the kids up here a little earlier. We do feel some, even though we don't know these people, when we see somebody in those kinds of situations, we feel some connection with them nonetheless. So relief efforts have been organized and carried forth, and survivors are being helped to rebuild their lives. Two former United States presidents and one-time political adversaries have become best buds. That works for the good, I guess. And this second stage is far from over. It will continue over the next few years. And those of us and in a position to help in any way should not let it get lost. We should not let it fade. But then even as this second stage was kicking in, there was another one that came in right on top of that. And I'm calling it the "How could God let this happen?" stage. Like Jackie Dulawos trying to fathom some reason for the flood he was watching, even as he could find none, many folk tried to find a role for God in the whole matter, on the assumption that such a role and such a God existed. The responses were rather, well, interesting. The Anglican Dean of Sydney, Australia, a Reverend Philip Jensen, kicked off something of a row after saying that such disasters are part of God's warning that judgment is coming. And the chief executive of the Federation of Islamic Councils, Imam Amjad Ali Mahmoud, weighed in with, "We need to seek forgiveness in the event that we have done something we're not even aware of." But the president of the Hindu Council of Australia kind of demurred on that, saying he didn't believe the disaster was a direct result of God's anger, and on this kind of conversation went. Now, however differing the opinions expressed may have been, and however different the particular religious context from which they arose came, there was one common underlying assumption in all of them, that there is a supreme being who somehow had something to do with this devastating event. Well, one of the more honest and more soulful expressions I found in this whole "what's God got to do with this" question was in the Christian Century magazine. Christian Century is a journal that usually reflects, or kind of generally reflects the theological and social and cultural and political perspectives of kind of liberal mainline Protestant Christianity, mostly in the United States. And it's a journal for which I have a great deal of respect and appreciation, even when I don't completely buy into all of the stances and its expressed opinions. And I want to read to you the opening paragraph of the opening editorial in the Christian Century from just this past January the 25th. It was one I actually paid more attention to than the others that I read. "It is hard to speak theologically about the Indian Ocean tsunami without being banal or obscene. To say that the event reminds us of our finitude or of our inability to control nature is to mumble platitudes. To say that God willed such devastation for some greater reason is to administer a theological slap in the face to the tear-stained faces of all who mourn, especially the parents who mourn their drowned children. To say God was powerless to do anything to stop this disaster may make the divine seem less monstrous, but it leaves us with a God not worthy of the name." Now, the author of this editorial is not identified, and that's really not important. I can only read the first paragraph here. It went on for some time after that. And whoever it was, he or she wrote this out of a real sense of compassion, a real sense of pain, and out of what clearly appears to be a real struggle over the soul, within that writer's soul, as to what this disaster meant. And of the four sentences in that paragraph I just read, I am in full agreement with the first three. It's the last one that trips me up. It's the last one with which I have to take respectful exception. I'll read it again. "To say God was powerless to do anything to stop the disaster may make the divine seem less monstrous, but leaves us with no God worthy of the name." Well, to my liberal theistic friends, with whom I have a great deal in common, when it comes to things like assessing the state of our society and our world, how persons of faith should respond to it, and with whom I and with whom presumably we share a great deal in common in wanting to aid the victims of this tsunami, to these folk I would say that those few words capture perfectly for me the bind one puts oneself into and the knots you can twist yourself into by insisting that the only God, quote, worthy of the name, is a willful and all-powerful deity who rules over all of creation, including the world of nature and natural events. To throw in a personal note here, I moved over to the Unitarian Universalist ministry from that liberal theistic camp when I found that I could no longer, in good faith and conscience, accept the idea of such a deity as that. My break with fundamentalism had already taken place a number of years before that. I didn't become a UU to get away from the fundamentalists. I'd already taken care of that sometime earlier in my life. It was this particular issue that caused me, that got me here. Now, does that mean that I've completely abandoned the idea and the search for a God, quote, worthy of the name? Well, not quite. That search goes on for me. And I'd like to share a little of that search as we move on through this sermon as well. I found that to let go of the idea of a willful and all-powerful God is really not all that scary. It means, among other things, accepting the idea that the natural world and the universe in which we live is one that regards us, in Albert Camus' well-known words, which I have cited on numerous occasions, that regards us with benign indifference. Setting aside the actions and the doings of human beings for just a moment, put that aside for a moment, our natural world, in all of its machinations, does not wish us harm or evil, for the simple reason that it doesn't wish anything at all. Things like harm and evil are human ideas and constructs. And as human beings, we have to take them very seriously. And we have to deal with them as such, because human beings do inflict harm and evil upon other human beings and upon the earth as well. And we have to take it seriously on that score. But a tidal wave, or a tsunami, or a tornado, or an earthquake, or any other natural phenomenon you can name, and to which we have affixed the term disaster, knows nothing of harm or evil itself. And neither is there a deity behind such phenomena who knows of such things either. Where there is a mindless wave claiming the lives of tens of thousands of people, or a mindless multiplication of cancer cells claiming the life of a single individual, there is no willful intent, evil, good, or otherwise, in either case. Because we are human beings, we are rightfully and we are understandably devastated by such happenings. And because we are human beings, we rightfully and we understandably grieve and mourn such happenings. And because we are human beings, we rightfully and we understandably try to design measures to prevent or at least mitigate in some way such happenings. That's all well and good. In fact, to not be devastated by such happenings as these, and to not wish to reach out to those affected by such happenings, would be a denial of our very humanity, and Rand's disciples notwithstanding. But such things are not about God. What then, if anything, is about God? But this is the last piece of the puzzle I'm going to try to work in today, knowing that there will be future Sundays for further consideration, but I'll go with this for the morning. We may live in a universe that is ultimately indifferent to us, but that doesn't mean we have to be indifferent to it or to one another. We human beings have been given a capacity, a sense, an intuitive kind of consciousness that lets us know that we have a relationship to and with the rest of creation, even as we are a part of it. We don't fully understand, we may never fully understand what this relationship is all about. We know that sometimes we are blessed in this relationship, that this earth on which we live and the larger universe of which it is a part nurtures and sustains us and accords us meaning and gives us a place to play, just as children play along a riverbank. For some of us, the earth itself is our primary spiritual wellspring. That's what earth-centered spirituality is about. But in this very same relationship, we can be hurt, terribly and horribly hurt at times, just as easily as we can be blessed. And we entered into this relationship with all of life when we drew our first breath, and we will remain in it, for better and for worse, until we each draw our last. And we had no choice, really, about being in this relationship. Our parents took care of that, and their parents before them, and their parents before them, as far back as you want to take that. But we are each given, I believe, something that I call the power of the human spirit, or the power of the spirit of life itself, that allows us to live meaningfully within this relationship through all the turns that it takes. This is not a spirit that is confined to our individual selves, however, but one that finds its greatest expression as lives are shared and touched and reached out to, both in times of joy and in times of crisis or loss. And for those who wish to choose, or for those who choose to call such a spirit of life God, I consider that to be a God indeed worthy of the name. This is not a God who has power over the natural world, but one instead who gives us the power and the means to live in relationship with that world through all the twists and turns that such a relationship can take. And this is enough. This is all we need. Indeed, it is all we have. We have to live here on the paths of every day, encountering what every day gives us, and give back what we can to every day as well. And in so doing, we also, in the words of the poet Edwin Markham, build eternity in time. So let's sing that together. Let's sing number 312 here on the path of every day.